You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. Loneliness is often fodder for music.
Lonely, I'm Mr. Lonely.
Painting, like in Edward Hopper's Nighthawks, where a solitary man eats alone at a diner, his illuminated form reflecting into the city night. Or poetry, as Emily Dickinson explored in The Loneliness One Dare Not Sound. But while artists have long plumbed the depths of solitude's impacts on the soul, doctors are only now focusing on its consequences for our well-being. In fact, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy recently said that social isolation was an epidemic. Years of isolation from the COVID-19 pandemic certainly took their toll, but the advisory said that people were increasingly experiencing loneliness well before that. Patrick Rowey has been studying social isolation in older adults, and the announcement came as no surprise to him. He's a clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. I spoke with Rowey about the Surgeon General's report, and he started the conversation by discussing some of the factors making people feel alone.
There's definitely a lot of research showing that we are all becoming less connected over time. And the Surgeon General is highlighting some research showing that all of our social networks are getting smaller. And the amount of time that we spend interacting with other people in person has really radically decreased over the past couple of decades. Also, our involvement in the community at every level, from participating in clubs and religious institutions, have all declined.
And what do you think is driving that? Is it the way we live? Is it the fact that young people often move away for work? Is it our declining church enrollment? I mean, it's just hard to understand what multitude of factors are putting us in the place we are today, which seems like a really bad one.
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint, you know, exactly those reasons. But, you know, the reasons you suggested, and some people blame technology. In my work with older adults, technology is actually a benefit because it can provide folks creative ways to kind of stay in touch with friends and family and, you know, opportunities to stay connected and support groups. But for other people, it can definitely, technology can really take over all of our attention, and we use it to the exclusion of interacting with other people.
Yeah, I just did that at lunch, actually, before we taped. I sat with headphones connected to my cell phone, and I browsed social media and the New York Times app, and I didn't speak to anybody at lunch. I am the problem, Professor.
Perhaps.
The Surgeon General's report cites research that compares the health effects of social isolation to smoking up to 15 cigarettes a day, which is very alarming to think about. But I'm wondering if you can get a little more specific about how the health effects manifest. Do they have physical manifestations, or is this primarily a psychological effect?
Both. So loneliness has been shown to lead to all sorts of negative physical health outcomes. It increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, diabetes, and loneliness also leads to all sorts of negative mental health issues like lower well-being, higher rates of depression, and even higher rates of suicide attempts.
I imagine that loneliness is relatively difficult to diagnose. It's not necessarily something a patient would offer in clinic. It strikes me as something that's somewhat shameful and embarrassing to say I'm lonely. Do doctors now ask about this in a primary care visit, for example?
I think many doctors don't. The primary care system has gotten a lot better for screening for depressive symptoms, but I think loneliness is an unacknowledged kind of problem. And it can be really tough because it's not just reflecting the number of social connections we have or how often we interact with other people. It's a much more subjective feeling of distress that we have when we feel that we don't have meaningful social connections, or that we feel isolated from others, or that we feel that we lacked companionship. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. There can be some stigma or shame in actually, you know, talking about that.
obviously, there are these larger societal-wide changes that can and should be looked at to prevent loneliness. But what actions can individuals take to combat loneliness in their own lives or in the lives of the people around them?
Yeah, and I come at this question from the lens of thinking about older adults, and some of whom may be experiencing disability or problems kind of getting out. So, you know, finding creative ways to increase social interaction with family and friends above and beyond in-person contacts, which are, you know, ideal and best. Ways to get tangible assistance that they need from other people and emotional support. There are many, you know, online support groups, and the Institute of Aging has promoted a 24/7 friendship line that older adults can access if they're feeling in need. Senior centers in the community offer an awful lot of programs and services, both in person but also remotely, to increase social connection with other people. There's one really great program. It's a pen pal program that promotes intergenerational contact between older adults and school-age kids.
I'm curious, is there a hierarchy of the types of outreach? Like, is an email better than a text message, but a phone call is better than both of those to combat loneliness?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it depends on the person, what they can do that helps them feel most connected to other people. And there's some trial and error too, right? To try something out and see how you feel about it.
Whether we acknowledge it or not, people do change throughout their lives, and they can become more or less isolated with those changes. Are there big warning signs, like life events, that put people at greater risk for loneliness?
We do know that there are certain groups of people who are more at risk for loneliness, those with low income, those who live in rural communities, and any group that has experienced discrimination or being marginalized. So racial and ethnic minority groups or LGBTQ plus individuals. Otherwise, warning signs, you know, it could be problems adapting to, you know, physical limitations or COVID and some of the restrictions. Now, many of us have continued our lives as normal, but many folks who are still vulnerable with medical conditions are still experiencing some of those physical and social distancing, you know, requirements associated with COVID.
I imagine when it comes to life events too, something for an older adult like losing a partner would be a huge trigger for loneliness, because oftentimes, I mean, you're not just losing your direct companion, but you may be losing some connection to your wider social network through that person.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the research has found that, you know, just having one individual that we feel that we can rely on and get companionship and support from is such a powerful protector. So if we lose that one person and we have a really limited social network otherwise, that's a big risk factor.
What would you like to leave people with here when it comes to how to recognize loneliness and how to combat it, what kind of intervention they might be able to pursue to help somebody close by or somebody in their wider social network?
Well, I think when loneliness becomes more chronic and we have a harder time managing with some of these strategies on our own, that it's certainly okay to reach out to others for help, to reach out to family, to friends and professionals in some cases. So, you know, part of the Surgeon General's report was oriented to the importance of mobilizing the health sector and really making sure physicians and other providers are trained up to recognize loneliness and to offer kind of support.
I imagine that lowering that stigma that we talked about would go a long way too, because right now, my idea of texting somebody saying I'm lonely, you know, would you like to talk? Mm-hmm. I have a little like kind of cringe in my gut, feeling like I would have a hard time reaching out and saying that. And I imagine a lot of people would too. But if we would all just sort of get over that and say, hey, there's no shame in feeling loneliness, especially in this modern world, and speaking about it is the very first step to getting help, I mean, that could really change things.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's consistent with what the Surgeon General is saying about the importance of kind of building a culture of connection. And just like we're talking about now, it's normalizing the experience of loneliness, and it's fine to talk about it, and it's fine to let people know that we're feeling that way.
Patrick Rowey is a clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Washington's School of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
In the face of this epidemic of loneliness in the U.S., we wanted to learn more about how people are connecting. So we reached out to the Legacy Letters Program. It's run by the Goldson Institute at the University of Washington, and it encourages intergenerational interactions, specifically connections between seniors and those under the age of 18. The program is centered around a single document, a letter.
The letter is the tool to engagement. Most of us know what a letter is. It's manageable. I'm not saying come write your memoirs or your life story.
That's Dr. Karen Fredrickson-Goldson, the director and founder of the Goldson Institute. Throughout the program, people of different generations find commonalities and differences in what they've been through. Usually, there are five participants within each generational group. They reflect on their own lives through activities like the River of Life, which ask participants to reflect on questions like,
what have been the experiences in your life that have been transformative? And what experience that you did not anticipate being transformative, but it was transformative, just as an example. People, they have to really think about that, but then it opens up a lot and it really helps them get started.
In addition to those self-reflective exercises, there are activities where people find commonalities, like something called When the Wind Blows. Basically, a musical chairs type game where participants find other people with similar life experiences. Fredrickson-Goldson calls these activities flash bonding, simple ways for people to connect quickly.
Oftentimes, people, when they look at just their own histories, they actually feel more different. But then when we look at When the Wind Blows, they actually are exploring commonalities, what's common across their experience as well as what's different.
Over the course of the program, participants write their legacy letter, a document that describes themselves and the wisdom they'd pass on to future generations.
Sometimes younger people think, I don't have a legacy, but what we're about is creating and through the program, helping people see and enjoy and engage with their own legacy that everyone has.
Dr. Fredrickson-Goldson says, perhaps unsurprisingly, participants don't always jump into forming tight connections across generations.
There was a lot of trepidation about that, but yet they walk away from that experience really having more self-awareness, but also more understanding both of themselves and their experience, but also across generations, and are excited about it.
The Goldson Institute is gathering data to study the Legacy Letters program. Dr. Fredrickson-Goldson says that initial indicators point to people feeling more connected after the program. She also says that people are gaining skills to connect after difficult experiences in life.
People have to learn, in some cases, they have to learn how to join or rejoin. Some people had been very engaged in other parts of their life, but perhaps it was a death of a partner or a serious illness, for example, for an older adult, and all of a sudden they became more lonely and more isolated. This idea of rejoining and learning to have the skills to reconnect, and this program can provide some of those skills just through the questions that are asked.
And we'll post more information about the Legacy Letters program on our website, kuow.org/soundside. And we send out a text to our listener group asking for ways that you stay connected. And we got responses from many of you discussing the communities you've built through little free libraries, religion, and yes, even Magic the Gathering. Here are a few of those responses.
Put down electronics and say no to automation of cashiers, sales staff, banking. Make time for people. They are worth it.
As a member of the Seattle Baha'i Faith Community, I make a commitment to visit with not only my co-adherents, but also others with whom my life intersects. Strengthening bonds of friendship and support is essential for our continued well-being.
Recently, I've sought out third spaces. In particular, I've picked back up my old hobby of Magic the Gathering and am playing weekly at Mock's Boarding House. Having a space outside of work or the home just to engage with people who share a passion for a hobby and nothing else in particular has really begun enriching my life.
Oh boy, I haven't played Magic in a hot minute. That sounds excellent. Thank you so much to everybody who wrote in. That was our producers reading messages from Goryeo, Cindy, and James, discussing how they stay connected and find community. Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m., Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.